From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Catholic Church requires sexual abuse reporting, Uber goes public, and the Red Sox, well, some of them, go to the White House.
Each Red Sox player is a shining example of excellence living out an American sporting tradition that goes back many generations.
We'll discuss in our weekend review. Also today, a win for lobstermen who say they're hurt by efforts to protect right whales.
That's a blame game, and there has been no blame placed on us. We realize that there are deaths to the whales, but we're not the reason.
Plus, should there be term limits for Jeopardy champs?
Watching a guy who's played 22 games, it's like watching the dream team go to the Olympics. I mean, Holzhauer is a professional. At this point, you know, he's mostly indestructible.
We'll hear from a local winner. It's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Friday, which on this show means Week in Review, starting with the local sports celebration at the White House yesterday.
It's my pleasure to welcome to the White House the 2018 World Series champion, the Boston Red Sox. Very special group of people.
But that special group of people did not include American League MVP Mookie Betts, pitcher David Price, outfielder Jackie Bradley Jr., shortstop Xander Bogaerts, or manager Alex Cora. In fact, most of the team's players of color skipped. Most of the players who did attend are white. One exception, slugger J.D. Martinez, teased President Trump, but in a gentle, apolitical way.
Thank you, Mr. President, for this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be honored today here at the White House. And I know celebrating a Red Sox victory is tough for you, given that you're a Yankee fan and all.
The president managed to swallow his New York pride and offered praise for Boston.
Boston teams have won six Super Bowls as well as an NBA and an NHL championship. And this has to be a great time for Boston's fans. If you think of it, what Boston has done in a short period of time is pretty amazing in a lot of ways, but in sports, certainly.
Let's turn now to our Week in Review panelists. Marie St. Fleur is a former Massachusetts state representative, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Welcome back to the show, Marie.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis. He's the executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Welcome back, Jim.
Good to be with you.
All right, Jim, let's start with you. What was your take on the way this whole Red Sox White House saga unfolded this week?
Well, you know, on a day in which we imposed 25% tariffs on $200 billion worth of goods with one of our major trading partners, that we are talking about the Red Sox visit to the White House tells me that we are in Boston.
That's right.
Look, this is an extremely sensitive White House. Remember that Stephen Curry decided he wouldn't go, and then he got disinvited after deciding he wouldn't go.
The whole team, I think. The whole Warriors. Yeah.
But you know what? Look, it's been about 150 years since the first amateur baseball teams went to visit the soon-to-be impeached Andrew Johnson in the White House for the first time sports teams went. And since then, we've had many people decide not to go. Manny Ramirez decided not to go twice. Tom Brady decided not to go to the Obama White House or the Trump White House. The Bruins goalie Tim Thomas famously decided not to go to the Obama White House. And this is over and over again happens. Michael Jordan decided that golf was more important to him than going to the Bush White House. That's Bush number one, by the way.
Larry Bird skipped in 84, which we talked about. And some of these players, like Tim Thomas, you mentioned, offered sort of big, long explanations for why. Marie, most of the players for the Red Sox didn't elaborate on why they didn't want to go to the White House. But pitcher Hector Velazquez did. He said he was offended by the president's rhetoric toward Mexico. And then manager Alex Cora, who's from Puerto Rico, offered this explanation to sports radio WEEI this week.
You know, just being around the island and knowing what is going on and how people are, you know, it doesn't feel right. I made sure, and I've been saying it all along, I said it last year, I said it this year, the government has helped, but we still have long ways to go. And I put it in capital letters. This is our reality. I'm the guy that has lived it. I'm the guy down there, you know, in the off season. I understand how it is, you know, and I just don't feel right going and celebrate while people are struggling back home.
Marie, I see you nodding your head there. Do you understand where he's coming from?
Well, absolutely. You know, I think in the past and with all the folks prior to Obama, I would say this was a non-political statement. You know, a president invited teams to come and celebrate. But this has become a very political statement. And so I think that it was wise of them not to get caught up in the in a picture op with this current president. As I thought about this, you are the company you keep, right? And I have no problem with respecting the office of the presidency, and you should, because that office belongs to us. It does not belong to whoever sits there. They're only there for a period of time that they're elected to be there. I think that the members of any sport team has a right to decide to attend or not attend. But in this particular instance, particularly folks of color and particularly folks of good conscience, I understand why they don't go. I mean, this is a gentleman in this office who has decided to totally disrespect people of color, particularly people coming from the areas that Alex Rodriguez and many other folks of color have come. In fact, he actually has spent a lot of time essentially dehumanizing us. And in so many ways. And so when you have a president where, you know, it's okay, an individual, okay, because I don't think that's the office asking that individual to behave that way. In fact, I think that office expect the person holding it to actually be the standard bearer for who we are, the better angels in us as Americans in this country. But when you have an individual in that seat who says it's okay to rip Latino children from the arms of their parents, separate them, okay, and then we have no idea, took no care in determining the end destination of their parents, where you have kids that were so young who don't even remember who their parents are and will probably never be able to be reunified, I think for a person to then go and then celebrate, I think it's beyond the pale.
So it's deeply personal, right, for some of these players?
It is absolutely deeply personal.
Jim, I'm wondering, though, I mean, you know, what's the message sent, though, by these players, too? Because, you know, as Marie mentioned, there's the notion that maybe you should just respect the office of the president. We've heard that argument. I'm thinking of somebody like John Henry, who did go, the Red Sox principal owner. He also owns the Boston Globe. The president, of course, trashed the Globe last year for organizing that series of editorials nationwide that were critical of the president. I mean, he set that grudge aside and showed up. So there's that argument that you should, you know, set aside those arguments, those grudges, I should say, and just go.
Look, I agree with everything that Marie just said. I guess the point I would make is the nexus between sports and politics for me is an uninteresting one, just as celebrities with politics is not interesting to me. And you mentioned Larry Bird. Mm-hmm. I think his quote when he decided not to go is he said, "If the president wants to see me, he knows where to find me."
That's right.
And that's how
probably
I feel. If you want to go, you go. And if you don't want to go, you definitely go. If you want to make a statement, make your statement. It's absolutely cool. But it's like any individual. I wouldn't hold them up on any pedestal beyond any average individual doing the same thing.
All right. Let's move on to a national story this week that has local implications. The ride-hailing company Uber is trading on the New York Stock Exchange for the first time today. As we were coming on the air, it was trading at about $44 a share, which is lower than the company had hoped. And this comes 2 days after thousands of drivers for both Uber and Lyft in cities all around the world, including Boston, went on strike. We spoke with full-time Uber driver Kyle Tisvair this week. He's an organizer for the Boston Independent Drivers Guild.
I'm a firm believer in that these companies should be able to make money. But the way that they're doing it right now is they're subsidizing rides and they're underpaying their drivers. They use this upfront pricing because they think they're going to make more money in the long run, and they keep chipping away and chipping away at the driver.
Now, CEO Dara Khosrowshahi spoke with CNBC this morning while in the backseat of an Uber. How fitting. And he compared his company, Uber, to another tech behemoth, Amazon.
Just like Amazon went from being a bookseller to being an incredibly broad retailer, we want to go from car hire, essentially, to being a transportation on-demand service. We want to be Earth's everything transportation store.
Earth's everything transportation store, Marie. That's a pretty lofty goal. What are you thinking about these days?
Well, then they should really try to be an Earth transportation store that really values equity and that really values the large number of people who work for them they call them contractors, but in essence work for them, really. And so they should do that. I mean, in this gig economy where they can actually raise in private equity about $62.5 billion, they then now are probably, what, valued at probably over $80 billion, yet they take advantage of many people who uses that, who use the gig economy as an opportunity to put food on their table and to take care of their children. The reality is they use them as contractors, and so they have no payroll. No payroll taxes are paid by them. They really do not support them with insurance. They do not support them with workers' comp. And so these folks are out on their own when they're ill. So I think that they have some responsibility if they're going to establish a new economy, that they create a different economy that just simply doesn't take advantage, but actually builds equitable access to a living wage.
Can I ask you, though, I'm curious about the valuation that you just mentioned, because that number stands out. And you're right about right. With the IPO, they ended up being valued at $82 billion when they went public. But that was lower, Jim, than they were hoping for. Reuters had originally reported that investment bankers told Uber that they could be valued at $120 billion if they went public. And then they originally priced hoping for a range between 90 and 100, down to 82. They're trading today below that. And what's going on with this company? Is it what Marie's talking about? Maybe investors aren't so happy about the business model that puts the squeeze to drivers.
I don't think anybody really knows exactly what the business model is, and I think that's one of the problems. I think there are three problems here. One is, look, there was incredibly – and this is not to diminish the value of the folks who are out in the street striking, but if you look at the number of people striking, it was 25 in London, 25 in L.A., a couple hundred in San Francisco, which is their home base, 50 in New York City. Even though it's small, though – Uber pushed back big time. Why is that? Because Uber knows that it's a very slippery slope for them. The things that can cap their growth in the short term is unionization and government regulation. They've seen this movie play out in parts of Europe where, for example, in Rome, they're not allowed to really operate with any expanse to them. The second thing is I think Uber is a place that they have to behave in a monumentally crafty way, a bit like Amazon. They're not like a PayPal. They're not like a new service that goes into one area and basically own the space. They're competing with existing providers of that service. That means they have to roll up a whole bunch of services, push people out of the marketplace, and they can basically try and set their price. The question
is meant, by the way, that they've had to spend handsomely to do so, right, to stay ahead of Lyft, and they're not yet profitable.
Absolutely. I think the point here is, though, what happens if they raise their prices to make money? They start losing market share. And the other thing is, and here's the ugly truth, I think that, or this is what they're aiming for. Their money will be made when there are driverless cars. That's the business model. And they're trying to work out for the next 5 to 10 years till they get there. And that is a pretty ugly truth that all of us have to try and deal with. What do we do about that? The equity issue that Marie raised is a real issue. So there's a lot going on there. I think the investors stay in this, the ones that have stayed in it, because they see the long term. They're not doing it for the next 5 to 10 years of profits.
Yeah, we heard the same thing this week from Bloomberg's Anne Mastu, who we had on the show. She said that they're also aiming for the driverless cars. And so, Marie, as Jim says, there's kind of a broader automation trend going on here. We've seen this come up in the Stop and Shop strike, in the Marriott strike. Automation is a big deal in a lot of these working professions right now.
Absolutely. And so, therefore, regulators do have to take a quick look at this and understand what the implications are going to be for the workforce that's being generated out of there. Because you have the reason why you probably have a significant people don't show up for these types of strikes is because, you know what, this is the only way that they're able to make a living. Mm-hmm. And so there's a fear factor here. So there's a deterrence in going out there and organizing against Uber. It's a double-edged sword because on the other hand, a government hasn't done what it's supposed to do with really establishing a transportation system that is equitable, that allows a lot of places. So in some of the communities here in Massachusetts, who actually don't have access to fair transportation, and so for some families, that is actually a good way for them to be able to get transportation back and forth. And so I think if we begin to take a holistic look at our transportation models and to figure out how this fits in, it's not a bad idea. Because I think that it's important that we say that it's not a bad idea. But I do think there's a level of equity and fairness that is not being built into the system. And as soon as they get those driverless cars, those folks that they're now propping up – are going to be left behind. And so government has to step in and figure out what is the best way for the system to move forward.
So we've got a lot to watch there. The stock price, driverless cars, a lot of trends that we'll be watching for with Uber and Lyft in the years to come.
Right.
In the moments that we have left, I do want to ask you both about some news out of the Catholic Church this week. Pope Francis has issued new rules, requiring priests and nuns to report incidents of sexual abuse or cover-ups to church authorities. However, the sweeping regulations do not require reporting to law enforcement. And for folks like Ann Barrett Doyle, who's the co-director of the Boston-based group Bishop Accountability, that's a major shortcoming.
This new law does not mandate reporting to civil authorities. What it does is deepen and systematize the internal process for handling allegations. The problem is that the church is inherently secretive, and this does nothing to change the secrecy of the Catholic Church.
So what do you think, Jim? Is this a positive step forward? Does it still not go far enough?
So on the one hand, it's about time they do something that's much bigger and much more consistent than they had done before, but this is just not far enough. I completely agree with what she just said in the sense that I think the solution here, and this is also true of higher education, where higher education has gotten to the space of trying to adjudicate potential crimes on their campuses. I think this is a simple thing where if there's a crime or an allegation of crime, you take it to the civil authorities. It's a much cleaner way to do things because whether you are the Catholic Church with hundreds of years, thousands of years of history of keeping things from civil authorities or your institution of higher education, you are conflicted. One, you're not equipped to adjudicate, but second, you're conflicted because you're trying to protect your reputation. Problem is people get hurt in the meantime.
Marie, though, one of the things that we heard out of the big summit that the Catholic Church held earlier this year on clergy sexual abuse was that one of the reasons perhaps to not require mandating to law enforcement is that there are parts of the world where Catholics and Christians are a persecuted minority. We saw some real violence erupt on Easter in Sri Lanka, for example, right? And so the worry is that if they go to law enforcement, they might be putting themselves in danger. Do you buy that explanation?
I think there's a balancing act that has to be. And so when you take a look at all of the United States, all of America, all of the Americas, and see the amount of the number of sexual abuse cases that have come out just out of that, we know that the church has not been good at policing itself. And so all we have is written into canon law the idea that the church will police itself. And we're still leaving children and a lot of others who are who do not have a way to fend for themselves at risk. So I agree that there's those instances, but I also think that there may be ways to mitigate that. And so the question shouldn't be, let's not do anything because there might be these instances in the world. I mean, there are tons of instances in the world where the law is applicable, the civil law is applicable, and it really challenges the opportunity for a select minority. And so the question is, what do we do in working with those civil governments in order to make certain that that minority is protected? It's not to say, well, let's just keep policing ourselves. It has not worked.
I'll mention that Cardinal Sean O'Malley has voiced his support for this new edict out of Pope Francis. He says in part, quote, this document directly addresses needed improvements to the church's response. And O'Malley goes on to say that it has become far more clear that the people of the church and our wider society rightfully demand substantive action for the disclosure, transparency, and accountability with regard to any occurrence of sexual abuse or intimidation or cover-up in the life of the church. Marie St. Fleur is a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis is the executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Our thanks to you as well.
Thank you. I'm going to vote for Marie St. Fleur once again, even if she's not running.
You can write her in. You can write her in.
No, I'm not running. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Cape Cod Bay is officially open for business as a seasonal ban on lobster fishing lifts today. The state's Division of Marine Fisheries pauses lobstering every year in an effort to protect the North Atlantic right whale, an endangered species with a population just over 400. The annual lobstering ban begins in February and typically lasts 3 months. But as the calendar flipped to May this year, right whales were still in the area, so the state extended the moratorium on lobster fishing. That prompted lobstermen to stage a protest in Plymouth yesterday. They say Massachusetts lobstermen already do more than their fair share to protect the whales and can't afford to delay their fishing season. Dave Cassoni participated in the protest. He's a lobsterman based in Sandwich, and we asked him how the fishing ban affects him.
Realize that at least one quarter of the year has been removed from harvesting the lobsters. Not that that one quarter of the year is the most active time for us because it's the winter. The weather is not always accommodating, and we realize that.
So when you are lobstering, Dave, what precautions do you take to try to protect whales so that they don't get tangled?
All right. We have in the industry, and Massachusetts, by the way, was the very first to enact a lot of stuff to protect the whales. Our industry in Massachusetts, we've done the most. We have breakaways, weak links at the buoy. If where the vertical line comes, you realize you have a trap on the bottom. It could be in a string of traps, a trawl, but then there's a line that goes to a buoy. We have a weak area at the surface that will break at like 500 pounds pressure, which is a mosquito bite to a 40-ton whale.
I see. But there is some debate, though, Dave, about how much impact the gear can have, positively or negatively. I mean, we spoke earlier with Pete Kendrick, who's a 25-year-old lobsterman fishing out of Plymouth. He says he doesn't think the gear does really much of anything.
With all the things that we do personally, for modifying gear, changing out lines, markings, in my opinion, it has done nothing to help or hurt fishermen or the whales. It more looks like better on the paper and point a finger to if a whale ever got entangled and died.
So what do you think about that, Dave? I mean, Pete is wondering whether the breakaway lines really are any better, that maybe it's just optics to look good.
Well, first of all, we have no parameters to know whether they work or not. In other words, if we go out and a buoy is gone, we have no idea why that buoy is gone. Was it an encounter with a whale that broke it off? So, yeah, that would be a frustration point to an awful lot of people. But, again, there is no indication that it doesn't work.
So what are you looking for then, Dave, from the public and from government officials? I mean, is it reimbursement for those losses? Is it just someone to acknowledge that you're bearing the pain of trying to save these whales? What are you hoping for?
Well, basically, everybody is out there studying the whales. You realize that there is an entire industry. People will say, oh, the economics of the whale watch industry is a value to the Commonwealth. Basically, to us, it's an expense. It costs us by not going out. Of course, it would be great to be compensated, but we're not looking for that. What we have to do is we have to become very realistic in the approaches we're going. And the realistic approach is how much has to be done in order to save it. No one, and we realize this, no one wants a major species to go extinct on their watch. I'll back up a little bit, too. We're not placing blame anywhere, but not one northern right whale death has been attributed to coastal Massachusetts lobster gear.
Although, Dave, though, there is a federal survey that shows that between 2010 and 2014, that 82% of right whale deaths nationwide were caused by entanglement. So whether it's happened here or not, it is a real threat.
We understand that. Where else in that world are there as extensive impact on an industry with closures and all the rest that's being done other than in Cape Cod Bay?
So your concern is that by saving whales, you're hurting people?
Well, you're hurting a little microcosm of the industry, us in Cape Cod Bay. I mean, nowhere else is it closed. I have to say, I can't say nowhere else. They just put closures in the Gulf of St. Lawrence on the Canadians, which hadn't done much up until last year. So we're closed. We're the first ones to have used the breakaways, the sinking ground line, marking. We mark our gear so that that's a blame game, and there has been no blame placed on us. We realize that there are deaths to the whales, but we're not the reason, yet we do the most to conserve that. And so we're not asking to throw other people under the bus. Just let's be reasonable and fair and take a very serious look at it as to where they go. If we have 40 or 50 whales here, where are the other 350 or 400 whales?
That's Lobsterman Dave Cassoni. He fishes out of Sandwich. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
And joining me now is Regina Esmudez Silvia. She's Executive Director of Whale and Dolphin Conservation North America. Welcome, Regina.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you. And I know you just heard Dave Cassoni there. Does he have a point, Regina? I mean, are Massachusetts lobstermen shouldering more of the burden than their counterparts in other states like, say, Maine or even Canada?
I mean, I think in U.S. waters, the Massachusetts lobstermen have definitely been subjected to more regulatory measures than in other places. And unfortunately, that's largely because Cape Cod Bay is one of the few known places where right whales aggregate seasonally. And so they are at a much higher risk in Cape Cod Bay, you know, during the time that they're here, because they're hanging out in these big groups, and it's an important habitat. And there's not a lot of places along the East Coast where we know where they have these big aggregations. So there are some restrictions in the southeast in the calving area for fishing. When the whales are down there, there are, as Dave mentioned, some closures now up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, which is a relatively new place that right whales are starting to aggregate in the summer. So the places where right whales are known to hang out, unfortunately, that's where the conflicts with some of the fixed gear fisheries occur, and that's where some of these regulatory measures start to develop that do impact the fishermen but are done as a means to seasonally try and save these whales.
I see. So there aren't very many of these places where the whales congregate, but in the few that do exist, are they regulated as tightly as Cape Cod Bay?
I think that, you know, Canada has certainly, I mean, they had a terrible year in 2017, and they had 12 whales die. And as a result of that, they did start to last year, and they announced this year that they are going to put some closures in and some pretty strict regulatory measures in to slow ships down. So it's relatively new for that area. For Massachusetts, it's been a little bit more long-term. We've known for a while that these right whales are aggregating here in the late winter and early spring. And so the closure, that's why the closure was put in place here. So I do think that they have had a much longer history with being subjected to regulatory measures in Massachusetts because of the right whale aggregations. And it is the only state that does not have an exemption to sinking ground line. And it is the only state that along the East Coast that has a closure. So, that's very true. The gear marking, unfortunately, it doesn't mark necessarily to Massachusetts, it marks to the Northeast region. So when gear's coming off of whales, it's really difficult often to identify, because it's usually the line, it's not the marking buoy, to identify exactly where that entanglement took place. So tracing the locations of where these whales are getting entangled is very difficult.
Regina, let me ask you about the lifting of this seasonal ban, because it comes a day after the lobstermen protested, as we said. But we also know the Division of Fisheries routinely surveys the whale population, and they say they just did an aerial survey and found only one whale still in the bay. So that's why they lifted the ban. I'm curious what your take is. Do you buy that, or do you think the state actually was pressured by the lobstermen?
I don't think they were pressured by the lobstermen. I mean, I have tremendous respect for the state of Massachusetts, who has done an incredible job, I think, of walking a fine line between trying to do what they can to protect the lobster industry as well as to protect the right whales that come into Massachusetts waters. And historically, this is not the first year that the ban has been extended. And what they typically do is the same thing that they did this year, where is that they will work with the Center for Coastal Studies, put a plane up, survey the area. So they extend the ban usually in one-week increments, and then if any of those surveys have shown the whales left, they lift it the second that they can. They don't keep it in place any longer than they had to. So that's happened historically over the past few years, and that's exactly what happened this week as well, is that the plane has been going up every day that the weather has allowed. They knew that right whales were leaving for the past, you know, 4 days. They had seen fewer and fewer right whales on surveys. They had a plane up yesterday. It was somewhat serendipitous, I think, that this event occurred on the same day that the plane happened to come back and say that they had one whale in the bay. So
yeah, so that lines up well, and now everybody will be at least happy until the next season rolls around, I'm sure. Regina Esmuda-Silvia is Executive Director of Whale and Dolphin Conservation North America. Regina, thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you. Bye.
Stay with us. Coming up, should there be term limits for Jeopardy champs? We'll hear from a local winner. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The Jeopardy! Winning streak of sports gambler James Holzhauer stands at 22 games after he nailed yet another final question last week.
Let's come to our champion, James. He had 47,381, and he wrote down, what is crowdfunding? And that is correct. He will add how much money today? 35,000. That's 82,381 today, and now a 22-day total of $1,691,008.
It seems the only thing that can stop Holzhauer is a break in the competition. Jeopardy! Is in the middle of its annual Teachers Tournament. When Holzhauer returns a week from Monday, he'll continue his quest to break the records Ken Jennings set on his memorable run in 2004. Jennings won 74 games in a row, earning $2.5 million. Long winning streaks and seven-figure paydays were made possible by a rule change the year before Jennings appeared on Jeopardy! Repeat champions previously had to retire after five victories. Now, one of those five-time winners says Holzhauer's incessant dominance is making Jeopardy, quote, incredibly dull. That's the argument of Tom Nichols. He won Jeopardy the maximum five times in 1994. These days, he's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and Harvard Extension School. Tom, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Nice to be back, Cal.
So you tweeted earlier this week in part that there is, quote, no hope for people who were new to stop a guy who's been handling the buzzer for so many games. Just like Ken Jennings, he won't be beaten. He'll play until he makes a mistake. Incredibly dull. I don't know, Tom. A lot of people seem to enjoy watching, like the Yankees or the Patriots win over and over. What's so wrong with having a run of dominance like this?
Well, the problem is whether you think of Jeopardy as a sport or as entertainment and a social occasion. I think the charm of Jeopardy from the time that I watched it as a little boy was that you were amazed that, you know, the local librarian or firefighter or your neighbor or the guy who ran the grocery store turned out to be a kind of hidden gem of knowledge. One of the early winners was a transit cop who busted, early Tournament of Champions, a guy named Frank Spangenberg. Everybody loved that, like, you know, the world's smartest transit cop. Now, you know, Holzhauer, who, by the way, you know, is earning his money, honestly, in the old-fashioned way by beating the board. But I think one of the reasons they retired you at five was that after five, you were basically turning pro. And so this to me is like watching a guy who's played 22 games. And I felt the same way about Jennings, by the way, winning, you know, 40, 50, 60 games. It's like watching the dream team go to the Olympics. These aren't really, Holzhauer is a professional and he beat the board fair and square. But at this point, you know, he's mostly indestructible in part because of a mechanical advantage that you get just from playing the game enough times. I felt it. two or three games in, and I remember one of the contestant coordinators telling me that by my third game, nobody wanted to play me.
Well, you know,
now, that's three games. Imagine 22.
Yeah, Tom, we actually have some old sound of your third game now that you mention it. This is you on one of your episodes of Jeopardy in 1994. So you've just blasted through the first four correct answers in a category, and here comes the last one.
Tom.
What is Duke?
Yes. Five in a row for Tom. He is fast on that signaling button in addition to being very bright.
I got to say, Tom, watching that footage, you looked like you were working hard. You were almost sweating. There was a real physical element to it. But tell me a little bit more about the button, this buzzer. We've heard a lot about that, both in your tweet and in other breakdowns of what makes Holzhauer so successful. It seems like such a simple thing. What's the big deal about the buzzer?
Well, there's two things to understand. First of all, the business of starting at the bottom of the board is something Jeopardy used to gently try to discourage you from doing.
And he does it all the time.
Clearly they've changed that, and they've changed the rules about, you know, money and caps, as you pointed out in the introduction. The physical thing about the buzzer, the thing that people can't see at home, is that your buzzer doesn't go active until the very moment Alex is done speaking, and there's a light off camera that will turn on the minute Alex is done, and that tells you that your buzzer's hot, that you can go, because you get locked out otherwise. And if you ring in at the same time as other people, you get locked out. And that's why you see people clicking the button over and over again. The trick to Jeopardy, I think, is, and you can see Holzhauer doing this, you kind of ignore Alex. And you even see Holzhauer talking over him. I mean, Alex is trying to introduce a category, and Holzhauer just says, whatever, 200, 400, 600. You kind of ignore Alex. You look over at the board. You read the question, because you can read faster than he speaks. You decide if you know the answer. And really, all three contestants always know about 95% of the answers, because you're all screened out by a very tough test just to get on the show. So everybody's roughly as smart as everybody else. And then you stare at that light. And once you get that rhythm of the question, Alex speaking, the light, hit the buzzer, you know, that's by my third game, I started out in the first 2 minutes just running the first five questions of the board, because I'd been handling that buzzer for over an hour. And I think it was a good rule to retire you at five, because that really is the equivalent of turning pro. And once you turn pro, you shouldn't go back to the Olympics.
So I know, Tom, that you see this as getting kind of dull after you got essentially a pro who's winning over and over. But apparently a lot of viewers disagree, Tom. I mean, the ratings are really good. According to Deadline, the latest ratings for this Holzhauer run puts the show at number one in all syndicated programming, ahead of Judge Judy. That's a big deal. 2 weeks in a row. I mean, this is the most watched season in 14 years.
Well, that tells you something, doesn't it? I think you have to give some kudos to Chuck Lane at the Washington Post, who was the first guy to get out on this limb, who said, yes, the ratings are high, and that doesn't say anything good about us. People have, you know, there are high ratings for a lot of things. The Kardashians are superstars in America because of high ratings, but that doesn't mean I would encourage people or think that it's a good thing to watch endless episodes about the Kardashians. I think it tells you something that, you know, instead of a show, again, where you're watching and seeing, you know, the transit cop and the firefighter and the teacher, that, you know, professional gambler from Vegas is just looting the board and pretty much ending the game about 15 minutes in, because he racks up enough money with the kind of steely bets that a professional gambler would make with all that money on the board. When I played, it was half the amount of money. They doubled the amounts about the time they lifted the caps. This is about as interesting as putting a camera in the sportsbook room at Caesars. professional gamblers are very good at what they do, but I don't want to watch them work all day.
Last thing, Tom, while I have you. I mean, most of us will never get a chance to play on Jeopardy, maybe because James Holzhauer will never open up a slot. But in any case, the rest of us are just on our sofas yelling answers at the TV. What advice can you give us? Are there any tips that can make us amateur Jeopardy players do better?
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing that Holzhauer did, and again, I have all the respect in the world for James Holzhauer. I mean, this is not, I don't blame him. I blame the show for changing the rules that made his streak possible. Because once they changed the rules, this was going to happen. Holzhauer practiced standing up, and I can't explain to you why that's different. But if you stand up and don't shout out answers until Alex is done speaking while you're holding something in your hand about the size of a fat magic marker, it makes a difference. It's easy to sit there with, you know, in your Barca lounger having a beer and, you know, just yelling out random words. But that's not how the show works. You have to be really focused on that timing issue. And there is something different about standing up for a half an hour. I filmed all five of my games in one day. So, I mean, there is almost, it's kind of like the Masters where you have to walk, you know, it's kind of like having to walk the golf course. So there's something about standing up that I think just changes the dynamic of the game.
Okay.
He's a very good competitor.
Well, and, sure. And now I know the secret. So, you know, when my wife wonders why I'm standing up and holding a highlighter in my hand watching Jeopardy, I'll explain to her it's helping me do better. That's the way to do it. Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and Harvard Extension School. And he's also a 5-time undefeated Jeopardy champion. Tom, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. But a little Jeopardy-style trivia on the way out with producer Zoe Mitchell. This production of 90.9 WBUR is the best show in town. Zoe.
What is Radio Boston?
Correct. I'm Callum Borchers. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.